You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Tonight we are hosting one of the great dancers of all time, Jacques d'Amboise, as you know. Jacques was a principal dancer with the New York City Ballet for more than 33 years. He joined the company at age 15 and became a principal dancer when he was 17. In 1976, he founded the National Dance Institute, which you'll hear more about tonight. He's been the recipient of numerous honors and awards, among them the National Medal of Arts and the Kennedy Center Honor. He's won an Academy Award, a fellowship from the MacArthur Foundation, and six Emmys. He's also the author of Teaching the Magic of Dance, and I think that's about as close to a grand slam as you get in this life. In his beautiful new book, I Was a Dancer, d'Amboise writes about his own rough-and-tumble childhood, his indomitable mother who actually bartered roast chickens for dance lessons, how a wild, untamed youth, as he wrote, learned nobility through art, about Balanchine and Jerome Robbins, Suzanne Farrell, and the moment he knew his dancing career was over and began a new dream, teaching children all over the world about the arts through the magic of dance through his National Dance Institute. In conversation with Jacques tonight, we're so thrilled to have Sasha Anawalt, a veteran dance critic and daughter of a dance critic. I think she's the only second-generation dance critic we have in America. Sasha has mentored so many arts writers in this country. She's made an incalculable contribution to arts writing in this country by founding the USC Annenberg Getty Arts Journalism Program and the NEA Arts Journalism Institute in theater and musical theater. She's a generous and vital hub of the cultural life of this city, and we are so honored to have her here tonight. She wrote the best-selling cultural biography, The Joffrey Ballet, Robert Joffrey and the Making of an American Dance Company. And she was chief dance critic for the Los Angeles Herald Examiner. Remember when LA had two newspapers? The LA Weekly and on KCRW and National Public Radio. And her reviews and features have been published widely. This is a quote from Jacques d'Amboise. "The art of dance is an art of communication that expresses emotions by controlling and ordering movement as well as tempo and molding and defining space. That's what our universe is about. We can hardly speak without signifying some expression of distance, place, or time. See you later. Meet you at the corner in 5 minutes. Even where are you going implies space and time. Every time you shake hands in greeting or raise a glass in a toast, you're participating in a dance. So now, please join the dance and welcome Jacques d'Amboise and Sasha Anawalt."
Thank you.
Louise, thank you. Thank you. Fellow life forms. Nice to be with you.
Hello, everybody, and it's wonderful to be with you, and it's extraordinarily exciting to have Jacques d'Amboise here. I saw Jacques d'Amboise in 1964. I was 8 years old, and that was the beginning of when I saw him dance. And I was talking to my parents, who took me when I was a child, and we went about three times a week, most often to the New York City Ballet. And every time you were on the program, my father reminded me the joy that filled us, that you were dancing, and you gave us so much joy beyond belief. Was your dancing, your partnering, just the life that you conveyed to everybody. Aside from dancing, Jacques is also an extraordinary teacher, and we are going to spend tonight talking a little bit about the beginning years and partnering, because partnering is such an important part of dance, and you are a beautiful, magnificent partner, and you have ushered so many young kids through the National Dance Institute into the world, partnering people in this way of dance. He's also an extraordinary storyteller, and this book is just filled with things. I have a list of things that I didn't know, like you grew up in the same street as Tiny Tim.
Yeah. Ukulele guy.
Ukulele guy that Rock Hudson would, who he didn't know was Rock Hudson, would pick him up and take him to the set of Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. I didn't know that George Balanchine only had one lung. These are sort of small little things. And then there are these stories, miracle stories. This book is full of, oh my God, he should be dead, but he's not. And
yeah, I should be dead.
You should be dead. So the first story that I wanted to tweak with you is one when you were pretending to be one of the Three Musketeers, and this idea of glory dreaming, that he started with this teacher, Madame Seda, who began teaching him ballet with his sister, and he felt that feeling of jumping. And he's I'm going to let him tell you about it, but this idea of jumping so high that you jump up and you touch the fire escape, you jump up, you cross Central Park, and filled with this notion of the Three Musketeers, you wound up on top of a roof at night when nobody knew he was there, dressed as one of the Three Musketeers, and he jumped
off the roof. Yeah.
35 feet. Fortunately, it was not six stories, which would have been on the other three sides had he picked any of the other three sides, and lands on the roof of the building next door to where he lived in Washington Heights in New York. And first of all, everything should have been broken at that point, but it wasn't.
Well, it's the nuns. The nuns. You go to a Catholic school, and these women who you hear are married to Jesus, and they have the ring, and they're always got their hands fumbling with beads underneath this thing. You never see their hair, and they never seem to need to go to the bathroom or anything. So Sister Carmelita says, if you do the novena and do it honestly and truthfully, the entire novena, you could ask the Blessed Virgin Mary for your wish, and she will intercede with little baby Jesus for you to get your wish. What child could refuse his mother? So I think, I'm going to fly. I'm going to ask. So not only did I do the novena, I tripled it and did more and more and more, but I didn't really pay attention to the escape clause. What child could refuse their mother their wish if it was good for them? Right? If it was good for them. So I did the whole novena, triple everything, made myself a costume. At midnight went up and said, now I'm going to fly, and went to the roof and jumped. Right? Well, it was only two stories, one and a half to the next roof if I went the other way. But then I had scraped my leg, sprained an ankle, and broke my sword that I had made like that. And, of course, knelt down and apologized to Jesus for having the sin of pride that I could. And then I went to the door to try to get off the other roof, and it was locked from the inside. And I'm going to be stuck with my shredded clothes and broken sword, right? So I think I have to get out of here. I'll sneak down the fire escape. So I limp my way down the fire escape, and then I hang from the edge and drop, right, 12 feet or something. And then, and I think, now I'm in the alley, I'll get home. Well, the door to the cellar is blocked. So how do I get, what do I do? They're going to find me in the morning sitting outside in the alley in my shredded clothes with my knee. And then I see the little window to the coal bin, because we used to heat with coal. And so I managed to crawl in on top of the coal and roll down the heaps of coal and get out of the cellar and up I think we were fourth floor, and then sneak in. I had left the key, right, on it to get in the apartment, and now I had to clean up all the coal dust and the evidence and wash the tub and so on, hours. And then I opened the window to the alley, and I threw my black uniform with its cape and the broken sword, and I looked down and watched this black cape swirl down, thinking, goodbye, Satan. So be careful what you tell children.
Your book ends with the novena. There's a full novena at the end of the book.
Oh, no, because I tried to find out what's the origin of the novena. So I asked my mother, right? She said, oh, well, in Canada, we do the rosary this, and we do it so many times and so many times like this. And I said, the nun said, you only have to do three. Oh, no, we do nine. So I did, I don't know, 24 or whatever. But so I looked it up for the book, and the history of it is, I mean, when you read it in the footnotes, you think, how could anybody ever believe this? But then if you've read the Book of Mormon, you got to read the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon, John Smith gets a message to go in 18-something up to a tree in New York State where he will dig out gold plates. You know how much gold weighs, right? If you look at the Book of Mormon, it's three or four times the size of this, I mean, I don't know, 500 pages of little print. How many gold plates would it take, right? They would reach halfway across the country if you lined them up, right? But it's a hieroglyphic that he has to wear the Urim Thurim. What is the Urim Thurim? Jewel spectacles that you put on that immediately translate these hieroglyphics into English, right? I mean, oh my God. And so the novena is nothing compared to the Urim Thurim. The Urim Thurim wins.
Can you tell us how did you get to ballet and about your mother and
Well, my sister, we were in Washington Heights and West Side Story time, right? Gangs and all that. And you belong to different levels as children, young ones. You join the guerrillas. And the guerrillas were lookouts for the next gang that were breaking into cars and people's apartments and stuff. And then from there, they went on to serious. By then, you're 15, 16. And then after that, you're in jail. Or a cop, either one. It depends. So I was in the... I didn't join the guerrillas because my mother would not let me hang out on the stoop when she took my little sister up to ballet class. I had to go. And I'd sit, and there'd be 12 little girls in pink with my sister, who was the best in the class, 181st in, I think, Amsterdam Avenue. And this woman, I called her the gypsy woman. She wore black and red. She had black hair. And her name was Madame Seda. And she was Armenian, actually. And she would teach the girls, and I would... Then the rosin box was there. So I'd put my foot in. So at the end of class, she said, little boy, could you get up and jump as high as the girl? You're squirming in your seat with energy. See if you can do it. So I get up, and she gets me into fifth position, and we do changement, which only means change your leg in a jump. So she turns around. Wasn't that good, girls? Wasn't it? So a little girl, what? So I get applause from 12 girls.
That's it.
For this stupid little thing. So she said, could you do 32? The girls did 32. So I do 32. Well, you're the only boy in class. You have to do 64. So now I'm boing, boing, boing. And then she said, well, you make so much noise when you land. If you sit quietly next week when your sister comes for class, I'll let you do the changement at the end. But if you want to do it without making noise, you have to do the pliés at the beginning where you alight. So I would do the pliés. Then I'd sit down like a good little boy. And then I'd get up and do the changement. And of course, at home, I was doing changements all the time. And morning, noon, on the way up, walking every corner, I'd stop and do changement. And I guess my mother would say, for God's sake, will you stop with the changement? Anyway, so after about, I guess, maybe 3 lessons a month or so, and about 6 or 7 months, it came June, and my mother was taking the family up to Maine, Lewiston, Maine, where all the French Canadian relatives were. And she says to Madame, save a place for my daughter and my son when we come back in September, as if she was conferring a gift. And Madame Seda said, no, Madame, there's no place for you here and your children. Well, you never saw Sarah Bernhardt do such a scene. She was rolling with drama, my mother, saying, oh, choking, with right? And Madame Seda took a piece of paper and wrote, School of American Ballet, George Balanchine. And she said, take them here. They're better teachers than I am. Mm-hmm. Fabulous woman.
There's so much in that story, because the pieces also of challenging that Madame Seda, the way she taught you, and she got you going further and further, and pretty soon you're taking the full class, and also that she let you go on to the next thing, and that the wisdom of your mother too, and her tenacity with you. But this element of teaching goes throughout your life. Of
you were talking about that.
Yeah.
Look, learn this to finish your education. Bad word, education. Think about it. When did you finish your education? Oh, I have a master's. Oh, I finished high school, but I never got to college because I didn't have the money and I started with. Oh, Sonia, when did you finish your learning? Don't use the word education. Use the word learning. Education is injected in a brain. And now you learn this so that you can get the number of things that A or B or C or whatever, and then you pass, and then you hate the subject and you forget it as soon as possible. Right? So, learning. When did you finish your learning? So, here's the wonderful thing. How best do we learn? We learn best, first of all, by doing. There's no learning without doing. Real learning. The second is it must challenge you not to be as good as you are, but to be a little bit better than what you are. So that you try to, it has to challenge you like a game does. You play chess. Now, next game you play, you study the book and you play it better. And now you play it with a middle level, and then you play it. Finally, you play it with a computer, and it beats you. With that I can't control. So, here is Brother Norbert. I have 1 year of high school, and then I was asked to join New York City Ballet. I just turned 15, so I quit school and joined. So, Brother Norbert. Oh my God! This is Brother Norbert. He was small. He was very serious. He was Canadian, and he had been a famous basketball player, even though he was not tall. And he must have practiced alone to take the chalk and throw it, and it would cross the room and go in a waste paper basket. Wow. The bell would ring at the end of history. You'd have 5 minutes to get to the algebra and whatever class Brother Norbert was teaching. Everybody would dawdle in the hall till the bell rang for the class, but not Brother Norbert. You ran to get there and be sitting in your chair because he always came in differently. The bell would ring for his period to start. The door would burst open. He'd run across. He'd hit the wall. He'd bounce off. He'd hit the desk. He'd bump to this. Go against the back. He'd spin. He'd land in his desk. And he'd say, that's what molecules do inside you.
Oh.
He said, let's study the trajectory. And now he'd take the chalk. I went across the room. I went here. I went here. I went here. Look at the triangles. Right. How many feet did I go? Right. And we'd have a lesson. And then he did wonderful things. He would do this. Oh, my God, what a lesson. I'll make it simple. It was more complex. 5 and 4 equal 9. And he'd write 10. And then he'd put the gun and he'd look around. Why are you looking at me that way? And no one would say anything. Mm. And then he'd say, speak up. No one would speak up. And he'd go, oh, sorry about that. 9. Why didn't you question me? What a lesson. And why didn't you speak up if you afraid? Right? And then Peter Heavey. Peter Heavey was the biggest, toughest guy, and he never got sleep much because his father was the super. And every 4 hours, the father would have to shovel coal to heat up, and that's summertime because hot water came from the boiler too. So even in Peter Heavey, every 4 hours would have to go down and help his father. So he was always, and he always stood in the class at the Lurker's place, the family of Lurkers. If you're a teacher, right here, I'll show you where the Lurkers are. They're usually in that corner over there. They head for the far left corner of a classroom and they sit. In every classroom all over the world, a Lurker family is. Right? So Peter Heavey would be back there, half asleep. And Brother Norbert would say, in my class, in this school, 65 is the passing. In my class, if anybody gets below 90, I'm going to fail you. Mm. He said, don't worry. I'm the best teacher you ever had. And every one of you can achieve 90 like that. Well, he was brilliant as a teacher, and we're all getting straight A's and A+, except Peter Heavey. So it's getting near the end, and we can't, right? Gonna fail. Uh-huh. Peter Heavey's gonna fail. So bell rings from history, and we come running in to see what kind of entrance. Brother Norb, sometimes he'd crawl in like a snail. and different things he'd make. He's already sitting at his desk. And I come in with Joe Keane, running, and I go, come on, Joe, come. I say, oh, shh, Brother Norbert. Brother Norbert's here. And Brother Norbert's with his head on the desk. And now, as each person comes up, shh, Brother Norbert. So now everybody is sitting quietly. The bell rings to start the program. Next period, Brother Norbert is to start. He doesn't move. Joe, is he sick? I don't know. Wake up. I don't know what to do. Oh. The sigh comes. Our hairs go up. Looks up and goes on the desk. And he had taken a piece of cork, burnt it, and made black circles around his eyes. And he looked at us with these black circles. He says, I haven't slept for a week because Peter Heavey's going to fail.
Oh.
He said, how can we help? What can we do? Help me. And immediately Joe Keane turns to Jim Comiskey, who's the brightest kid in the class. Jim, I'm going to coach him on tomorrow night. Among the class, the brightest of the children got together and formed a tutelage group for Peter Heavey. And within a week, he passed. Mm. Peer pressure and community coming together to play the game of learning, sparked by the theatrics of this brilliant Brother Norbert. So he retired, and I always talked about him. And I would send every once in a while from Berlin or wherever I was dancing a postcard. Mm-hmm. I never got an answer. And then, 20 years ago or something, I got a message. Brother Norbert had retired. He had gone to a home for the Maris brothers. He died. And in the drawer next to his bed were all your postcards.
Yeah.
Why are we talking about teaching? Look what he did. Challenge. More than you dreamed of. Fear not, you have the best teacher. And then constantly making the, you would do this much, and then he'd go around and make sure you understood it. Then he said, this much is not enough. You can do a little more, a little more. Like he kept the stairway that you take step by step towards excellence. And that's how he taught, challenges. Challenges.
So if you walked into a room like this, and let's say it was an NDI moment, and this is a new schoolroom, a classroom of kids in the public schools, how do you start to sort out who you're going to work with, and what do you do?
Well, I don't teach that much anymore. I train teachers to teach. But the most important person in the class is the lurker. Whoever is having trouble. And they're usually a couple of boys. And they usually hang out together. And again, they're either in that the lurker corner. So the first thing you do is you separate them. And you put them up front. And the other thing you do, imagine you're in a class learning math. And there you are, and here's the bulletin board, and I'm the teacher. And after a month, you come in, and all the seats are the other way. And the bulletin board's over there. And everybody in the back or in the front. There's no last row. You at the front, you at the back. There isn't A, B, C, D. Suddenly the back is the front. And then a month later, the side. And the next month there. And then before you know it, it's a circle of learning people. Mm-hmm. With no A group, B group. Right? You're right up front. You must know what I'm doing. You answer the question. You at the back, pay attention to them. Already, it's going to fail in the back, right? The A group, the B group, the D group. You're in a D group. Already a failure. Why not the star team, the space cadets? Why not the apple group, the pineapple group, the orange group, the, mm-hmm. right? I'd keep away from the cabbages in the right.
But you had George Balanchine was one of your teachers, and you've learned partnering from Ubakov and all these extraordinary people. I want to talk about partnering because we want to show a clip of Jacques d'Amboise and
show?
Melissa Hayden. When are we going to show it?
No, what?
We're going to show the still point.
Oh, okay.
The Todd Bollander.
Okay. Well,
no, because okay. I want to.
All right. Good.
The partnering, and also, it gets to something that piece that you show, gets to the point of simplicity and of saying things right. in a very right. simple way, and what's been lost in dance a little bit, and what's been lost in right. our time, and what can be restored. Ballet is very hierarchical. It's not everyone in a circle learning. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but there are people who are principal dancers and people who are corps de ballet, soloists in the middle. So how did all this come together? And what did you do when you wound up in SAB? SAB is School of American Ballet,
this
which is the school for
took
years.
Took me 10 years to write for several reasons, and I wrote every word. But 30 years ago, I started writing a book about a quarter ballet girl in the hierarchy, getting out of the quarter ballet and getting her first role. She thinks it's a role. She's one of four behind a principal girl. But she's not one of 16 in the back line, right? And it's a thriller full of sex and blood and right. It'll be out next. That's gonna sell. Bring me back. But anyway, there is a hierarchy. There is a hierarchy. And in the case of Balanchine, Allegra Kent, the ballerina, put it best. He loved us all in varying degrees. So Jerome Robbins is teaching, doing a ballet, Aaron Copland's clarinet concerto, and it's called Pipe Piper. And there's a girl called Barbara Milberg, who's everybody, she was always complaining. If she had a period, no one yelled louder in the dressing room that she was, her cramps were killing her. And I mean, she was a real drama queen, right? And she had beautiful breasts, by the way. few ballerinas that really had beautiful breasts. So Jerry Robbins, for whatever reason, the ring Pipe Piper, Milberg comes in late, and he starts picking on her. He starts picking on her. It's, forgive me, you've got too much tit. You look too Jewish. Right? Jerry Robbins, Rabinowitz. He's Rabinowitz. His real name is Rabinowitz. Right? He picking on her till she cries and runs out. And he did it purposely because he wanted to make a move to have more power in New York City Ballet. And he went to Lincoln Kirstein and said, I can't allow her to walk out of rehearsal. The discipline will, and Lincoln said, the discipline, we can't allow this. This is like the military. General Patton would never allow it, right? So he goes up with Jerry Robbins in hand to Betty Cage, the manager of the company, for a meeting and ask Balanchine to come. And Jerry wants to fire Milberg. And Lincoln is there, fire her right away before this infection of discipline falling apart affects everybody. She has to go. Right? And Balanchine goes, you know, Jerry, how many people in your ballet? Jerry says, 16. Oh, well, we have 24 corps de ballet girls. Why don't you pick another girl? So, reasonable, right? But reason doesn't win at all. It's always emotions. So Lincoln saying, no, it's not that. It's the example. And then Balanchine said, you know, Barbara, I've known her since little girl. Now she's a beautiful woman, you know? And she is family. And because one of your family misbehaves, you don't throw them out the door. So Jerry turns around to look at Lincoln. Lincoln has turned his tail and fled. And Betty Cage is sitting there, well, I make sense. So anyway, there was a hierarchy. Of course there was a hierarchy. And Balanchine was faced by this all his life because the audience would see Andrei Aglefsky dancing with Maria Tallchief and they'd yell, right, Tallchief Aglefsky, tall, and the house would fill up when they were dancing. When they weren't dancing, it wasn't. And Balanchine couldn't stand that because it would be about stars and not about a company and about him. Right. So the same thing happened with his ballet Apollo. Everybody wanted Misha Baryshnikov to dance it. And so he taught Misha, and Misha danced it beautifully. And then he was going to teach it to Peter Martins, and he rehearsed Peter Martins. Peter Martins was gorgeous and a beautiful dancer, perfect body, and very kind of antiseptic Danish. Like that. And always posing. If I wanted to say to you, I love you, right? Now, the same thing, Peter would do the same beautifully, yeah. But it would be a pose.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
He was always posing. He partnered beautifully. He danced beautifully. I don't think he really liked to dance, honestly. He stopped early, too. I don't think he really, he just was so talented and gifted that as a little boy, he was down. Oh, you're going to be great. And right, like this, and everything came to him. But I don't think he really, Tamara, what is it that Alan Bergman said? about? You have to want.
The difference
what? I want to be a dancer. Yeah. I have to be a dancer. Big difference. I have to paint. I don't exist if I don't paint. Oh, I want to be a painter. Mm-hmm. Big difference. Mm-hmm. Well, Peter wanted to dance because he was successful. He couldn't fail everything, right? He never considered, oh, I'll be an engineer or this. Everything was there. He was perfect. I don't think he really loved to dance. Mm-hmm. I don't think so. Mm-hmm. But I don't know why I got into this.
But you, well.
Oh, right. Yeah, so Balanchine, I'm standing there in the wings watching Apollo, and Balanchine has cut the whole beginning and the music of Stravinsky. And I couldn't believe it. And I said, Mr. B, why did you cut it? And he said, you know, they big stars, all the audience wants is big stars making poses. So I gave them poses. He said, Van Gogh cut off his ears. Ear. In other words, he cut his own ballet.
Yeah.
He cut his own ballet. It's bizarre that he would do it, but he did.
He revived Apollo for you.
Oh, yeah, earlier.
But it's a really important ballet to your life, and in the book you talk about how it changed you, and also that the story of Apollo, which is I heard Louise's introduction, so it's the story of a untamed youth finding nobility through art, and you said my life
Washington
is
Washington Square, Washington Heights gangster kid, right. Having Stravinsky conduct and Cecil Beaton put on my makeup and Balanchine choreograph for me. Wow.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. So in that, you part those three dancers, you have three dancers with you in that ballet, and some of them are really
muses.
Important. Three muses. But I want to get to Melissa Hayden because we are going to see her.
Oh,
and,
my God.
An extraordinary, beautiful, magnificent dancer who you partnered a long time, very, very close to each other. I was telling Jacques before that I had one or two classes with Melissa Hayden. She is an incredible teacher. Just she looked us all in the eye and she said, she was in second position on the end of her chair, and she said, only one of you is going to become a dancer.
Yeah, yeah, that really gets...
And I knew it right away. It wasn't me.
Well, her name was Mildred Herman, and she was a Canadian Jewish girl that wanted to be an Olympic swimmer, and she was swimming like mad morning, noon, and night to make it to the national test, and someone got her into a ballet class. And then she gave up the swimming, and by the time she was 17, she was in Radio City Music Hall, and then within 6 months in American Ballet Theater. And then after a career there, but not a principal, she left so she could join Alicia Alonso and do solo and principal roles. And then in 1949, at the age of 25, she joined New York City Ballet. And at the age of 15 in 1949, I joined. And the two of us were in the company together. She as a principal, me as a pimply-faced teenage kid in the back. So we go in June to the Royal Opera House in Covent Garden to perform for 7 weeks. First it was, I think, 6 weeks and a week off something, but they extended it to 7 weeks. And then we did the provinces, Manchester, Liverpool, and Croydon. But anyway, so there we go. Now, Melissa comes into class, right? She was very black hair and very commanding, and she walks into class and she goes to her favorite place at the bar, but it was portable bars and on stage, and she takes it. And someone says, did you hear Jacques just had a birthday? He's 16. She says, "Oh, 16? The sweet little thing, 16, never been kissed. Come here." She grabs me and she kisses me. Lots of tongue action. And then she says, "All right, I'm going to kiss you every day for a year for your birthday." She's on her class. Right. The next day I'm waiting, puckered. She comes in. She gives me the kiss. Everybody in the class applauds. And then Balanchine starts the class and so on. It lasted a week. 1 week. And then she came and she kissed my nose, my ears, the back of my head, the top of my head. And then she said, "That's it, honey, for the year. I'm back when you're 17. There'll be something else." Anyway, we danced everything together. We danced and we would go on tour together between. See, she wanted to be perfect for the audience. And when people asked her, "What's your favorite ballet?" she said, "What I'm dancing tonight is my favorite ballet. It's my opening night and it's my closing night. Every performance I do, I look at it that way." So she wanted to be perfect for you, the audience. So she'd come, she'd have her 25 different colored vitamin pills. And then she'd eat this and eat that. And then she'd pull her thing and give herself a B12 shot in her butt. And then she'd say, "All right, come on, we're going to the theater to rehearse." I'd say, "But wait a minute, it's 9 o'clock in the morning." She says, "I don't care, nobody will be there, we'll have the place to ourselves." And then she'd test the stage. Then she'd wait till the lighting person came. "I want to see the lights," right? And then, I mean, everything. Now I got to go home and eat, have a massage. And she traveled with a portable mirror so that she could hang it in her, she had it folded up in a suitcase and opened it. She could hang it and do bar in her room. Look at everything. So we're in Peoria or somewhere, and the symphony orchestra does part one, an intermission, and they move the orchestra back to leave a little strip in front like that. And now we're going to do Swan Lake or something like that. And Melissa doesn't feel that she's at her peak. So she starts heading for me. Now I'm trying to stretch and warm up and like this, and I see her coming, and I know what she's about. I say, "Get away." I say, "Don't get away. I have my own problems. Get away." She says, "I just don't feel energetic enough. I have to have my adrenaline go. I'll pick a fight with a stagehand." And she pines this poor guy who's standing in the wings like this. And the music's, the overture's going, ready to come, right? 16, 15, five. She says, "Hey, you, you're in my way." And the guy says, "What?" Says, "Stand out of the way, buster. You're about to see the 8, 7, 6. The guy says, "Why, you bitch, da, 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 da." She's on stage. And now she danced beautifully, and I'm partnering her. Meanwhile, the stagehand's going up and down and in the wings, telling every one of the crew that there's never been a worse monster let loose in their theater. And after we dance and we're taking bows, Melissa tells the audience, and she goes, "Where is he?" Brings him out, kisses him on the cheek, and says, "I owe it all to him."
Oh. Oh. Yeah. That is wonderful.
Melissa.
So should we see her?
Yeah,
with
we got to see
Jacques d'Amboise. Okay.
And this, by the way, what's important about this, and I'm going to just digress. People can't have silence. People, you know, like it can't have, you know, it's like silence. They have to fill every word with noise instead of leaving a silence. "Hi, how are you? Hi, you know, like, it's how you doing? Hi, so, you know, what's all this talk?" You come in, they turn on the TV, it's on, they're cooking, they're eating, take a shower, they go to bed, the TV's on. It's noise all the time. And all the young people are filling it, and choreographies like that. They're afraid to do one beautiful thing and repeat it because maybe the audience will think they're not inventive enough. So there's another step and another step and another step and another. This has about three steps, this pas de deux and this whoop, Debussy. And this woman, she can't seem to relate. Nobody, every time someone is good to her, everyone, it's like someone comes, you come and you say, hello, how you doing, Harry? Harry goes, Now you're afraid to say hello to your best buddy because the bad manners of Harry affecting you. Well, this has happened to this woman where she's had rejection, so she's afraid to accept any kind of gesture towards communication. And that's the essence of this pas de deux. And it's actually a love pas de deux of gentleness and quality by Todd Bolander. And there's, I think, three dance steps in it. Let's take a look if we can. Russell, dear Russell, Russell's up there running everything.
It's Todd Bolander and the ballet Still Point.
Let's move out of the way so they can see.
Wow. Wow. That is just
beautiful, right?
It's beautiful.
And there's something that you don't realize in that choreography. It is impossible to say anything that is aggressive or demanding and tilt your head. You cannot say, yo. And why? Notice how much she bares her neck, how she rolls her neck. Because here are two wolves fighting about the lady wolf. And one is losing. And suddenly, that one that's losing stops fighting and bears the jugular. When you open your neck, it is sending a very ancient, mythic symbol of non-aggression. Mm. Says everything. Mm. And that's why. That's how ancient it is. We were wolves, all of us. Anyway, but you see how the choreographer used that mm-hmm. in the, right?
Yeah.
In the beginning, no. Don't touch me. In the beginning, it isn't this.
Yeah.
No. It's not. But at the end.
I think at this moment, we will open up the floor to questions to these human beings.
Life forms.
Welcome, life forms. And there are people with microphones, and just sit tight. I'm not going to call on you. Is that correct?
And you will you're going to give that to that lady before this guy? You're next.
Would you please reminisce about Michael Kidd and
Seven Michael
Brides.
Kidd.
And Seven Brides for Seven Brides.
Michael Kidd. I'm 17. I had this ballet done, Filling Station, and in it, we're performing in San Francisco at the War Memorial Opera. It's a big stage, and I'm in that corner, and I hit 13 pirouettes. Now, I had done that before, but on stage, on a bumpy stage, with the follow spot to hit 13 was terrific. And then after that, lots of bows and everything. And I didn't know it, but in the front row, Jack Cummings and Stanley Donen were the producer and the director of this movie, Seven Brides, had heard about this dancer and had come up from Hollywood to see it. And I come off after the bows, dripping with sweat, and there's these two Hollywood types. They have these kind of polished loafers with tassels, Argyle socks, lavender and pink open neck sports shirt, little jackets, tweed kind of things, or plaid like that, perfect hair, manicured nails, and they're standing there and say, I'm Jack Cummings, this is Stanley Donen, and we want you to be in our movie. We're doing a new movie and we want to, and I said, listen, I'm in the next ballet. I got to change. So I left them in the wings. So the next ballet is over. And I meet them, they're waiting in the wings, and they said, we want to take you to dinner after. So I go out to dinner, and they tell me about this movie based on the rape of the Sabine women and how they've done this movie, and they're looking for the best male dancers in the country and blah, 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 blah. So I asked Balanchine, what do I do after class the next morning? And he said, whatever, don't sign 7-year contract. No 7-year contract. They will owe you, right? They will owe you. Like, they give you lots of money, and then they give you more, more, more. But 7 years, you have to wait, right, till you get all this money, and it's, right? Don't do it. I will make your contract. I have nice lawyer, Mr. Khan, who made my contract thing. So Balanchine arranged that I would leave the company. We were heading on a tour. I would leave the company, fly to Hollywood, and they estimated that it would be 3 months, September, October, November, and then maybe about, I don't know, a couple of weeks shooting or whatever, schedule or thing. I think it was I think the whole thing was 3.5 months, including the shooting. They'd say, all the brothers on the set, 9 o'clock. Well, 9 o'clock, I have to do the Melissa Hayden thing. The vitamin pills, the so-and-so, get there early, do my bar. I'm dripping sweat at 9 o'clock, ready to dance, and nobody's there. And I think I'm in the wrong studio, the sound studio. I'm in the wrong sound studio. I start, right, I try to get the phone working. Is this, in comes a stagehand with a cup of coffee and a donut. I say, he said, yeah, it's about 9:20 now, right? Oh, they'll be here, don't worry. Well, somewhere around 10 o'clock, we start rehearsing and working. Yeah, pretty good work. 11 o'clock, coffee break. Buddy stops for coffee. 20 minutes later, we start again. 1 o'clock, commissary. Everybody's gone. The commissary's the most important place because everybody sits and watch who's sitting with who, and there's that agent making a deal. Oh, is that Elvis over there? What studio is he? When? How long's it going? Right? This is all going on, right? I eat in 15 minutes. I've got nothing to do. So Russ Tamblyn was terrific. He was in a movie. We would go running around the sets, and we would come to like these in the back sets, like, I don't know, Egypt or something. And Russ, who was a tumbler as well as a dancer, but more of a tumbler, he says, this is what they do when they're training parachute jumpers. And he jumps and he goes 18 something feet, hits the ground and rolls. And I'm standing there and he said, yeah, go ahead, just hit the ground, but don't try to break, just roll, right? So we're doing all of this and then, 2 o'clock, they're starting. I rush back, ready to go. Well, the director, Michael Kidd, who is fantastic, and Stanley Donen are in a meeting. Somewhere around 3 o'clock, they show up, and now we work hard, really work hard, till 5. Well, I'll give you the life of a ballet dancer. You're going to be in class at 9 o'clock. You don't want to eat a big breakfast, bacon and eggs and sausage, because you're going to be working so hard for an hour warm-up that you'll be standing in puddles of your own sweat. So you don't want food. Now, so you do a ballet class 9 to 10. Now at 10 o'clock, you start rehearsal. 10 to 11, supposedly with a 5-minute break, more often forgotten. 10 to 11, 11 to 12, 12 to 1. You're working with Robbins here, you're working with Tudor here, Balanchine's doing another ballet here. It's 1 o'clock. You have to be back at 2. You have 1 hour. You're going to rehearse from 2 to 6. You don't want to eat a lot, so you hardly eat any, a little bit. Right? And now you rehearse 2 to 6. At 6 o'clock, you have 2 hours till the curtain goes up. During that time, you want to eat something. You want to go on stage and rehearse what you're going to do. You have injuries, new partners you have to practice with. You have to put on your makeup. You have to test your costume, get everything on. You want to be down there at 15-minute call so that you can warm up and do the Melissa Hayden act with get her adrenaline going. But you don't do that. You leave it to her. And sure enough, curtain going up, and you're at your peak. And now, in my case, I was in every ballet pretty much. So from 8 o'clock till 11, rushing between ballets to change costumes and makeup if you had, you're dancing to a fantastic orchestra, Ravel, Debussy, Bernstein, right? Copland, Stravinsky conducting, right? I mean, incredible. With Maria Tolchieff and Taneki Leclerc and Eddie Villal over there and Aglevsky and the best dancers in the world. And now it's 11 o'clock. You're very hungry. Exhilarated. You go out and you pig up. You drink wine, you eat, and think. You go to bed at 1 and you're up for 9 o'clock class. But wait a minute. 8 performances a week. Matinee and evening. You do the same matinee, except you have 2 shows instead of 1. But before it, you have all the rehearsals and everything. Monday is your day off. But you take your ballet class, and maybe you go to a movie, or you rest. It's your day off, or go shopping. If you're on tour, which we were most of the time, that's when you do your sightseeing. You go to the Louvre or the Uffizi or the St. Petersburg, the Marinsky, or whatever. That's when you do your sightseeing. Some of the tours were 6 months. If you went from one city to the other, you traveled on your day off. Once on a 5-month tour in Amsterdam, in the Ballet Bourrée Fantasque, where there are 8 girls across the back. There were 2. One, my wife, Carrie, on that side, and Janie Mason on the other, and in between, 6 girls in the wings with bandages. It was the last performance in Amsterdam, but I don't see how we could have gone on. And so that's a day in a life. I expected that in the movies. Instead, I got coffee and donuts, and I joined the rest. But Tommy Rolfe, who lives here with Karen Shimoff, his wife, wonderful. Tommy Rolfe, he was Frankenstein in a movie. Listen, this is Tommy. Tommy, by the way, was a tumbler, world class, a ballet dancer, world class, and an opera singer. He sang full operas, the leads in operas. He also, on Broadway, won the Emmy, Milk and Honey, and whatever they give you. Is it an Emmy they give you on Broadway?
Tony.
So Tommy's sitting there, and we're on one of these breaks, right? Coffee break. And he's wearing his leather and his whole outfit, right? Red beard, wear frontiersman boots. And he says, "You want to see double tour, triple tour in a row?" I said, "What?" "Double tour. Double tour is you jump in the air, you turn twice, you land, right? So double tour, 1, 2, 3, double tour, 1, 2, 3, double tour." He keeps doing it. I don't know how many. I mean, it may have been 12, a series of 3 times 12. I don't know. He just kept doing this. And then all of a sudden he stops and he goes over and he, that's it. I don't know why to this day, why he did it. To this day, I don't know. Just bored.
A question over here.
This man, this wonderful man in the yellow, he was the first to raise his hand to the breach.
Not a lurker, you.
Well, first of all, congratulations on the lovely contribution that you and your very talented daughter made to a wonderful documentary a couple of years ago about the creation of a chorus line.
Every
little step.
Were you the producer of that?
No.
No. It's terrific.
Yes.
You can't believe this. It's a redoing of Chorus Line, a story of a story of a story, and it works as good as the first one.
Yes.
It's amazing that the people that did that were geniuses.
Yes. The question I want to ask you, back in the 50s, you worked with two of the great veteran film directors, Henry King and Michael Curtiz, on one of their last pictures, both of which I think are extraordinary musical performances. Could you please talk then about your work in Carousel with Henry King and The Best Things in Life Are Free with Michael Curtiz?
I had very little to do with either of the directors. It was the choreographer, and his name was Rod Alexander, and he was brilliant. But for Carousel, he doesn't really get the credit because Agnes DeMille, who had done it, said, choreography by Agnes DeMille, adapted by Rod Alexander. But it was Rod Alexander. It's cement we're dancing on. And at one time, I have to do four double tours in a row, but I had to do them on a dime because the chorus line are in a triangle coming this way, and at the very apex, I'm doing it, and if I'm off a little bit, I'm behind one of the lines. So I had to do it exact. And it had to come out of the shot before, so I had to do the pirouettes and the thing all the way around. And well, that they did it 10 times, just that scene, 10 times. That doesn't mean you do it, and then you go do it again. It means you do it, and then, all right, now, let's test the light. Well, his costume has a little sweat. The color will be a little different. I had three costumes, and if you have a red costume and you're sweating, it gets a little darker red with the sweat. So I would have to change the costume like this. It was 10 takes to get that double tour situation thing in. I was beat up, bruised and exhausted. I loved every movie I did. At the time, I didn't. And now, and when I think about, I can look at it and I can say, who was that? That's me in camouflage. Mm-hmm. I'm looking young. Anyway, it's fantastic. I didn't have much to do with the director. I didn't even really, I knew the name and a big famous, and it was Rod Alexander. The same with The Best Things in Life Are Free. Sherry North was, it comes out of one of those Hollywood movies, an excuse to do dance numbers and music by doing the history of the Silver, Brown, and Henderson. Black Bottom, the new twist, the birth of the blues, right? Wonderful songs. So there's a scene where she's hearing the pianist play it, and she dreams of the scene that she's going to be in, and I did my own stunts. Nowadays, you don't. By the way, there's all this controversy of the girl that did Natalie Portman's thing. They could not allow any Carousel. I stayed with Carl and Claire Andre. Carl Andre was Gary Cooper's double. When you see Gary Cooper get shot off a horse or run, it's not Gary Cooper, it's Carl Andre. Whether Gary Cooper wanted to do it or not, they wouldn't let him because they couldn't get insurance if the star was going to do the thing, right? They didn't bother about me. I was just a dancer. So I did. So I really did. I jumped off the bunk. I caught the rope. I swung across. I hit the wall, I think. And then I ran, and there was this construction that I have to jump over and land and not move. And then, and we would do that. And everybody from the other sets would come to watch because they say, hey, you got to watch this guy jump. It's like jumping over a car, literally. Mm-hmm. And so, but it was Rod Alexander's choreography. It was brilliant, wonderful choreographer. He's gone now. I think he died out here somewhere, AIDS or something. But he was a brilliant choreographer.
So we have time for one more question because we're going to sell books.
I got to sell books.
And
everything's in the book.
Jacques D'Amboise is going to sign books, and this book has so many wonderful stories you haven't heard. You know, it's just a great. So I want to give him a chance to sell them and sign them with you. So we have one more question over there. Okay.
Yes, thank you so much, Jacques, for giving all
Where are you?
I'm up here.
Over on this side, to the right, to the right.
Hey, John.
Oh, wow.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all these wonderful stories of your fabulous history. But this question is for the present. What we saw from the video is the beautiful lyric line even of the performance and with the music. And today's music is so boom, 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 boom. And the kids just go boom, 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 boom. How do you, with your dance program, teach the lyric line to kids today?
First of all, I don't teach. I teach teachers. And the way I do it is I make them apprentices when I do teach, and then I throw them to the most difficult school, and they die or not. And if they do, they get better, and so on. So here is this girl, Bianca. She was one of my children. She's grown up. She did a piece of choreography of such beauty where there is a girl sitting on a tall construction with long hair and a cello. And sitting on the stools are three girls with long hair. And this cello starts to play. And let me think of the words. When the cello plays, now give me a second. When the cello gives up the future, it starts to play. When the cello gives up the past and the imagined or real slights that were done against it, its heart starts to play, and it becomes such a drunken, joyful fool of itself that God leans over, and combs it into her hair. And at that point, this woman starts, and these three beautiful, they're puellas, which means girl, woman. They're like 13 or 14. Their little breasts, the beginning, and their hair. And they dance beyond belief, beautiful. Lyricism, beauty, drama, magic, through simplicity. I wish I could say that I had choreographed it. Mm-hmm. It's Bianca. What I can say is what every teacher should hope to be able to say. You teach your pupil. And then you sit down and watch them teach, and you say, oh my God, they're better than I am. Mm. And what could be better for a teacher to say? Their pupil, and the same, by the way, about yourself as a parent. If you did a good job, and your children grow up, and you watch them with your grandchildren, and you see them going through all the same problems, and you want to open your mouth and say, don't do that, or don't tell little Jane. Like, shut up and watch them. If you did a good job, they'll do better than you. Yeah.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.